From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As global temperatures continue to rise, so does the number of Americans willing to acknowledge the threat of slow apocalypse. A Monmouth University poll released Thursday found that about 8 in 10 Americans, including almost two-thirds of Republicans, believe that climate change is causing hotter heat waves and harsher storms. The Monmouth poll, if it reflects reality, suggests that the trend towards denial found by a Gallup poll in March is reversing. So, good, bad news, you could say? This latest poll was conducted before the White House released the National Climate Assessment on Black Friday for maximum obscurity. But word did get out.
Government scientists saying climate-related threats to America's physical, social, and economic well-being are rising.
The report says extreme weather in the U.S. just in the past 3 years has cost nearly $400 billion.
Stronger hurricanes and more frequent flooding. For the Midwest, an agricultural catastrophe. Extreme heat destroying crops.
This was the fourth congressionally mandated national climate assessment, 1,600 pages derived from the collective expertise of 13 government agencies. I'm no scientist, but it sounds pretty scary. Scarier still, after the self-described very good brain in the White House reacted with four of his very best words.
Yeah, I don't believe it. No, I don't believe it.
That refusal to believe is backed up in many precincts by vast ice flows of oil industry cash. Lisa Hymas, director of the Climate and Energy Program at Media Matters for America, watched TV's broken, bifurcated coverage of the National Climate Assessment. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So the National Climate Assessment dropped on Black Friday.
It looked like a pathetically blatant attempt by the Trump administration to keep it out of the public eye. But it didn't work. A lot of the print media did better than TV. The New York Times and the Washington Post, they have really strong climate teams. They did great coverage. But you saw it in smaller papers all around the country. The Columbia Journalism Review found that at least 140 newspapers around the country put it on their front pages. That includes places like the Chicago Tribune and the Miami Herald, 20 different papers in California. And many of those papers also looked at the local impacts. The Portland Press Herald in Maine, they had a big story about the national implications, but they also, on their print front page, had a big story about the impacts in New England specifically. But I think TV was a mixed bag. Sometimes the coverage was good and sometimes it was not. And in cases where the coverage is poor, we probably would have been better off without it.
You said that Sunday was the first time this year that the five major Sunday shows discussed climate change on the same day. We're talking about ABC's This Week, CBS's Face the Nation, CNN's State of the Union, Fox News Sunday, and NBC's Meet the Press. They all had segments. The most talked about one on Sunday was probably on Meet the Press.
Yes. NBC's Meet the Press featured Danielle Pletka of the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank that's supported by the Koch brothers. She used a favorite climate denier line.
I'm not a scientist. I look at this as a citizen, and I see it, so I understand it. On the other hand, we need to also recognize that we just had two of the coldest years, the biggest drop in global temperatures that we've had since the 1980s, the biggest in the last 100 years. We don't talk about that because it's not part of the agenda.
No, climate scientists have been very clear that the global climate has consistently been warming, and the hottest years have been the most recent ones.
Yeah. NOAA said that 2015, 16, and 17 were the warmest on record, but 2017 was only the third warmest.
I don't really find that comforting. You know, if you're not a scientist, you ought to listen to scientists. To say, I'm not a scientist, but I don't believe this, that's nonsense. I mean, one thing that was frustrating about this last episode of Meet the Press, host Chuck Todd later in the same show interviewed Tom Steyer, who got his start as an activist by focusing on climate change, and Todd didn't ask him anything about the report. The focus was just on the 2020 presidential race.
Let's look at how Fox News handled the report on the day it was released. Here's CNN's Brian Stelter with a recap.
The network actually spent more time talking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's shoes on Friday. Now, to be fair, the network's newscast did air several segments about climate change, about the crisis, on Saturday. But on the president's favorite talk shows, not a word.
Meanwhile, Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace also did not invite a climate scientist on to discuss the report. He spoke with Republican Senator of Nebraska Ben Sasse, who dodged the topic of climate action and spoke vaguely about the need for innovation.
Because you can't legislate or regulate your way into the past. We have to innovate our way into the future. And right now, you don't hear a lot of the people who put climate as their number one issue. You don't hear a lot of them offering constructive, innovative solutions for the future. It's usually just a lot of alarmism.
You know, notably, Fox's big name personalities didn't dig in on the report at all. They just stayed focused on their pet issues. Mm-hmm. So you had Sean Hannity this past week ranting about Hillary Clinton's supposed scandals and crimes. I mean, he's still doing that more than 2 years after she lost the presidential election. And you had Lou Dobbs scaremongering about the migrant caravan. And the Russia investigation is a witch hunt. That got a lot of coverage this past week, but the climate report didn't.
Margaret Brennan of CBS's Face the Nation did speak to a scientist about the report, NASA's Stephen Clark. But that exchange was very brief, and it was buried in a segment that was almost entirely about NASA's Mars probe.
Yes. So on the one hand, I was glad to see that Face the Nation actually asked a scientist about the climate report. We track how often the Sunday shows incorporate or talk to scientists when they're discussing climate change. And it's been almost 3 years since any Sunday show has asked a scientist about climate change.
What?
Yes.
Seriously?
The last time was in December of 2015. It was also on Face the Nation.
So many opportunities, so many national conferences, so many elections, so many extreme weather incidents, and nothing?
There are climate scientists who are really good public speakers and who do a great job of explaining the science in terms that normal people can understand, but they don't get the airtime.
I think the winner of the week's booby prize, though, would probably be CNN.
I think that's true. Rick Santorum was on CNN claiming scientists are in it for the money.
If there was no climate change, we'd have a lot of scientists looking for work. The reality is that a lot of these scientists are driven by the money that they receive.
The next day, we saw Tom DeLay, the former House Majority Leader.
The report is nothing more than a rehash of age-old 10 to 20-year assumptions made by scientists that get paid to further the politics of global warming.
He's the disgraced former House Majority Leader who had to resign after he was convicted of money laundering and conspiracy. Why is this guy qualified to discuss a scientific report about climate change? We saw Stephen Moore, a Trump-loving economist, making the same ridiculous claim on CNN.
Billions and billions and billions of dollars at stake. A lot of people are getting really, really, really rich off the climate change issue.
Then on Tuesday morning, John Avalon did a good segment on CNN where he completely debunked this notion that there's a big climate industrial complex and that scientists are just doing it to get rich.
Now, that talking point you're hearing is a classic bit of distraction and deflection. In fact, one of the scientists who worked on the climate change report, Catherine Hayhoe, confirms that she and her colleagues were paid, quote, $0 for their work. They could easily make 10 times their salaries by working for something like Big Oil.
But later that same day, on Tuesday, just hours after Avalon's fact-checking segment ran, CNN again had on Stephen Moore to make that same claim. And what was so frustrating about CNN having these climate deniers on to make ridiculous claims is they didn't disclose the fact that Rick Santorum and Tom DeLay, when they were in Congress, they got more than $700,000 each from the oil and gas industry in campaign contributions. Stephen Moore works for a number of groups that are funded by the Koch brothers. Last month, Stephen Moore gave a speech to the Oklahoma Oil and Gas Association. These things were not disclosed, but those men were allowed to accuse scientists of being in it for the money.
Why does CNN pay people like Rick Santorum to lie to the public it's supposed to be serving?
I will never understand why CNN pays Rick Santorum. Cable TV likes to have conflict, and they like to have sparks fly. But there are much better ways where you can do it, even if you do want the conflict. I mean, it's absurd in 2018 for a discussion about climate change to include someone who contends that we're actually in a period of global cooling. get people who all recognize the challenge of climate change, but propose different responses and solutions to it. There are plenty of conservatives who propose carbon taxes. Let's see them discuss and debate people who are proposing a highly progressive Green New Deal or a carbon fee and dividend approach. There's a lot to debate. It just doesn't have to be a denier against someone who accepts the reality of climate change.
Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Lisa Hymas is the director of the Climate and Energy Program at Media Matters for America.
Coming up, more theaters in the war over reality. Next stop, a place we haven't been for a while.
Fox News in the post-Ailes era.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This past Monday, the nation's itchiest Twitter finger fired another salvo from the White House.
Trump tweeted that the press is so totally biased that we have no choice than to take our tough but fair smart message directly to the people.
Something has to be done, including the possibility of the United States starting our own worldwide network to show the world the way we really are.
This, of course, is not a new idea. The U.S. Agency for Global Media oversees multiple government broadcasters, including Voice of America. Never mind that, the president has previously yearned for a station to call his own. Which seems odd now, considering his special relationship with Fox News. But while that channel may act now like a seamless extension of the White House, it didn't start that way, at least not so blatantly.
Roger knew that in order to be successful, you have to sort of cover your tracks a little. You can't come out and say, we're conservative and this is what we're going to do. You have to be smarter than that. You have to keep that fair and balanced slogan front and center.
Alexis Bloom is director of the upcoming documentary Divide and Conquer, the story of Roger Ailes.
Roger is the man who almost single-handedly built Fox News Channel from absolutely nothing into the most watched news operation in all of cable.
Revolutionary in American politics.
Was in the Nixon White House, worked on the re-election campaign for Ronald Reagan.
You could really credit Roger Ailes with helping to create three Republican presidents.
Alexis, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
This is the story of an evil genius. Can we begin with the genius part? At every stage of his career, Ailes' intuition seemed to counter conventional wisdom, and the results seemed almost magic. You start in the 60s with a syndicated midday talk program, The Mike Douglas Show.
He was one of the youngest producers ever on The Mike Douglas Show. He was very good at it. And when Richard Nixon came on the show, Roger Ailes made a play for him and sort of springboarded himself from Mike Douglas into Richard Nixon's life.
The political legend had it that in 1960, a sweaty, 5 o'clock shadowy Nixon lost a TV debate with JFK and blew the election.
But that we cannot discuss our internal affairs in the United States.
What was Ailes' solution when he went to work for Richard M. Nixon?
In essence, Ailes said to Nixon, you know, baby, television ain't working for you. Look at Kennedy, you know, he just wiped the floor with you. You've got to do something about your act because television has taken over from radio, you know, as the medium through which Americans will now understand politics. You have to stop sweating. You have to do something about your hair. We have to package you in a way that's more sort of heroic and less fumbling. I mean, he did the whole Man in the Arena series with Richard Nixon.
Thank you very much.
He put Richard Nixon in the round.
Well, thank you very much, Bud Wilkinson. And I think that all of our television audience, in view of this sports consciousness of this great city at the present time, will be interested a little about you.
Surrounded him by, he said, the American public, but it was, you know, all sort of acolytes.
Ringers.
Yeah, and shot him from high angles, you know, made Richard Nixon seem more like a big, strong leader.
Well, he succeeded, and thereupon Ailes had a new career. He did political consulting for a number of years.
with dozens and dozens and dozens of candidates, all Republicans, but he crisscrossed America, getting to know every state and every county, getting a real hands-on feeling for the American public.
And what the ordinary voter wanted. There's a sequence in the film about a commercial he shot for Mitch McConnell, now Senate Republican leader, but at that point running for a judgeship in Kentucky. McConnell wasn't quite the outdoorsman, eh?
No, but, you know, Roger had a keen sense that that was what was going to appeal to the population in Kentucky. So he plopped him into a fishing boat and he looks up and he goes, "What do I do now, Roger?" And Roger had already put a fish on the end of the line and he said, "Reel in the fish, Mitch."
But then he was pulled back into the world of TV. He was working for NBC at the time for a new cable channel called America Talking.
It's live TV. It's 12 hours a day doing sex shows, weather shows. There are a lot of pet shows. What's America saying today? That was his slogan for America's Talking. And he loved it. People say that's when Roger Ailes was happiest. He had complete control of this channel. It was financed by NBC. But at a certain point, NBC decided that they were going to sell it to Bill Gates. He was left out of the negotiations, and that pissed him off mightily. And Roger was filled with animus towards the suits at NBC. They said, "You can stay, you can still run it." He said, "No." He stuck his finger up at the suits and said, "Bye, see you later. And by the way, you know, you'll be hearing from me."
So I called Roger in his car and I said, "Hey, I heard something went down. Are you okay?" And he said, "Felicia, I'm gonna like they've never been before."
Rupert Murdoch saw that Roger was out of work, immediately picked up the phone, said, "Let's do something." And they built Fox News. And I think Fox News was always defined by its animus towards NBC. He was absolutely hell-bent on showing NBC how good he was and beating them.
"Hi, I'm Bill O'Reilly. Thank you for watching on our very first day. Well, we're going to try to be different, stimulating and a bit daring."
Fox News Channel wasn't quite today's Fox News, but pretty close. This is Bill O'Reilly again in the editorial meeting with his staff.
A library board in Helena, Montana voted unanimously to keep the book The Joy of Gay Sex on the library shelves.
"All right, that's good. Book that for the D block on Tuesday."
But it wasn't just the incendiary content and the blowhard male hosts like O'Reilly. It was also the women. Blonde, tight clothing, and legs actually lighted from below. Every woman on Roger Ailes' air was the weather girl, no?
He called the on-air talent strippers at one point. You know, he said, "We got the same girls, but shinier poles." He knew that the way to keep the demographic, which was older and male, glued to the screens was a sort of heavy and heady combination of fear and sex. The only thing standing between you and the apocalypse are these hot babes. And it worked.
All right, let's get to the truly evil part of the equation. Ailes was a serial sexual predator who actually extorted sex out of job candidates and staffers with a sort of drug cartel silver or lead proposition. "Sleep with me and your career will advance. Refuse me
and your career is over." He was famous for his not so charming one-liners. One that sticks with me is, "If you want to play with the big boys, you got to lay with the big boys." The woman in question demurred. He made a call to the Republican National Committee.
"So I asked a friend to ask around, and he called me back very quickly afterwards and said, 'You're on a no-hire list.'"
And essentially ended her career.
Now, we know that being shoved aside when America's Talking became MSNBC put a gigantic chip on Ailes' shoulder. But he told a story from his childhood in Warren, Ohio, that he claimed was the root of his mentality.
"He told me this story that when he was a boy, he and his brother had bunk beds and Roger was on the top bunk and his dad walked in and opened up his arms and said, 'Jump, Roger, jump.' And Roger jumped and his father stepped away and Roger fell on the ground. And his father looked down on him and he said, "Don't trust anybody."
Now, that's almost unbelievable. I mean, Ailes was a hemophiliac. A fall to the floor could have caused him to bleed out internally. But in his own Citizen Kane narrative, this episode was his rosebud.
But was it his rosebud? I mean, as with all things Ailesian, you have to take another look. I spoke to Roger's brother, Robert, who said there's absolutely no way that his father would have done that to him.
And it turns out, and I'm sorry to spoil your film, because you saved this for practically last, but this story is a trope. It's been told many times before by many a celebrity about their own childhoods.
Roger was a fabulist. He told stories that weren't true all the time, both about himself, about the way he was treated by his family, about what had happened to him. You know, he had this kind of alternate narrative about himself and his life. And I think most of it was in service of this image of him as an aggrieved outsider, somebody, you know, who had gone through a lot, upon whom bad things had been done. And in some way, it was kind of a justification for him being such a thug.
Now, incredibly, since Ailes' ouster over the serial sexual harassment and his death a year later in 2017, Fox News Channel hasn't mellowed. On the contrary, it's gotten more extreme, more hate speech, more conspiracy ravings, more explicit collusion with Trump's White House. What do you suppose Ailes would have made out of the Infowarsization of his baby?
The one thing that was of vital importance to Roger Ailes was the audience, not losing the audience. Do not lose your numbers. And he would have been pleased that Fox is doing so well, because they aren't doing well. And so, you know, in that regard, Ailes would have been right on board with where Fox is now. You know, on the other hand, he liked to keep the sort of fig leaf of journalism intact, not appearing to be so explicitly propagandistic. He liked that notion of fair and balanced. It gave him cover. So I don't think he would have been pleased with Sean Hannity jumping on stage with Donald Trump.
I talked about the caricature aspects of Roger Ailes as some sort of evil mastermind. You know, there's also some risk of caricaturing the Fox audience, which we've said has fed on the kind of ginned up rage that is the channel's product. But you know, his audience is not a monolith. Is there a way to view them more charitably than maybe I have done to this point in the conversation?
You have to view them charitably. I mean, they're us. They're Americans. There's plenty of people who watch Fox News who you and I would like very much and would have perfectly constructive, pleasant interactions with. There are also good reporters on Fox, but the people consuming it think that it's news, and it's not. It's entertainment. And there's a large section of America who only watch Fox News. They depend on it as their only news source. They don't read newspapers and they don't watch any other channels. And that's the problem. It's not necessarily that Fox exists, but that it sort of masquerades as something that it's really not.
Alexis, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Alexis Bloom is director of the upcoming documentary Divide and Conquer, the story of Roger Ailes, in theaters December 7th and on demand. Despite the founding slogan, the Fox News Channel's most visible primetime pundits were never exactly balanced or fair, and even less so since the channel's mastermind exited stage right. Consider two recent episodes. First, the onstage appearances of Fox hosts Jeanine Pirro and Sean Hannity at a Trump political rally.
4.5 million new American jobs, 4.3 million Americans off food stamps, 4 million Americans out of poverty, and we're not dropping cash loads of cargo planes of cash to Iranian mullahs that chant death to America. Mr. President, thank you.
And this week, embarrassment number two.
Here to help explain what's going on with the federal government, we got the EPA Administrator, Scott Pruitt.
Good morning. Good morning.
Great new studio.
First time I've been in your new studio.
Emails obtained by the Sierra Club revealed that the president's favorite morning show, Fox and Friends, handed former EPA Chief Scott Pruitt control over topics, questions, and even in one case, script approval in advance of his interviews.
We're doing, I think, a really good job as a country trying to advance innovation and technology to reduce our CO2 footprint.
You would think that people would be happy with that, but many in Hollywood and many on the left aren't, including one Stevie Wonder, who had a telethon.
Sarah Ellison covers media and politics for The Washington Post. She's been following the fallout, or the lack of fallout. Sarah, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Anyone fired or even suspended?
No, no one's been fired. As far as we know, no one has been suspended. Fox News said that it had spoken to Sean Hannity about his campaign appearance. A spokesperson said that the employee in charge had been disciplined for sending questions in advance to Scott Pruitt, but that's all we know.
Now, at other news organizations, heads would have rolled. So if the discipline is apparently so modest, you know, why bother even pretending?
There are elements of Fox News, for sure, that are very much more by the book than what Sean Hannity does or than what Fox and Friends does. Fox is sort of finding its way post-Ailes, and it's proven to be more difficult than they may have anticipated, not least because you also have to add in the factor of Donald Trump.
Long before Trump, Fox News has been populist and conservative, in cahoots with the Republican Party, sharing daily talking points and so forth. But these new episodes seem maybe to be taking the channel into a whole other dimension of partisanship and political activism. Or aren't they?
Well, Roger Ailes was very clear about the way that he wanted to operate. And for a long time, he was a kingmaker in the Republican Party. He would sort of create stars in that party that were media figures as much as they were political figures. What's different is that that influence and that weight has really shifted into the White House. The person who has sort of taken the place of the most powerful person at that network is Sean Hannity. I interviewed Bret Baier, who is one of the more straight and narrow of their personalities. He does one of their news programs, and he even said very openly that he knows that the president is watching his show. So it's not just the opinion programming. I don't think we have ever seen a sitting politician that is so influenced by one particular outlet.
Well, there's another thing as well. A couple of years ago, in the wake of Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly getting the heave-ho over their sexual predations, they were soon followed out the door by Ailes' number two, Bill Shine, who was alleged to have covered up the whole culture of creepy conduct at Fox.
Or at least ignored it, yeah.
And now he's Trump's deputy communications director, and his predecessor, Hope Hicks, is taking the top PR job at Fox. Have either of them really even left their previous jobs?
You know, it's a small, small world. For someone like Bill Shine, I think he knows the similarities between his old job and his new job. He's worked for an egomaniac, mercurial, difficult, accused sexual harasser. Now he's working for a different one. In some ways, he's just swapped out the names for a very similar type of situation. I think Hope Hicks comes with great reputation among some journalists. She doesn't lie to people. But you have to imagine, would she have been able to get this particular job if she had just worked for the Trump Organization versus in the White House with a sitting president who has the kind of relationship that he does with a lot of personalities at Fox News? And I think that she's going to be playing go-between in a way that she had never really imagined.
Ailes had never wanted the GOP to direct Fox's coverage. As you wrote earlier this month, Ailes, quote, wanted to run the GOP.
Right.
Now, there was some thought that with his departure and with Rupert Murdoch's sons and successors taking over the operation, some of the explicit collaboration would be rolled back, and along with it, maybe some conspiracy mongering and hate speech. but no such luck. This was author Ken Aletta while speaking at a live event with Lachlan Murdoch.
But are you embarrassed by what they do?
No, I'm not embarrassed by what they do at all. You have to understand that Fox News is the only mass media company in America with strong conservative opinion in prime time. It's the only one, right? And I frankly feel in this country, we all have to be more tolerant of each other's views.
Tolerance? Seriously? That's got to just be PR gloss to protect the goose that lays the golden egg.
Well, you've identified something, which is the difficult position that the Murdochs all find themselves in. Lachlan Murdoch's brother, James Murdoch, is leaving the company. He was the one who was at most at odds with Fox's opinion hosts. But ever since James and Lachlan Murdoch took over the company from their father, who is still alive and still plays a major role, they have wanted to sort of reform the place, but not change its key market position, which is extraordinarily profitable. They are not going to upset this apple cart. The one thing you have to remember about the Murdoch sons is that as much as this political moment is a surprise to them running this company, even though it's going to be a much smaller company because of the sale of most of the company to Disney, is something that they have been prepared for their entire lives.
You referred earlier to the news shows with the likes of Brett Baer and Shepard Smith, which have long been used to support Fox's claim to be a real journalistic operation. I'd call it the sheep's clothing. On the other hand, Fox was the first news organization after Jim Acosta of CNN lost his press pass to the White House to file an amicus brief in support of CNN against the White House.
There are real journalists, absolutely, who work at Fox News. And what everybody wants to know who's sitting in a chair like yours is like, how can they continue to work there? This is so embarrassing. It's state TV. People just say, I do what I've been doing for 20 years at Fox News, keep my eye on my own job. But certainly after someone like Hannity jumps on stage with the president and is essentially campaigning for him, it becomes all the more important for that news organization to act like a news organization for all kinds of reasons, to protect your sources, to preserve the confidentiality of your source relationships. That's key for anyone who's in this business, even nominally. And so, yes, there are real journalists there, but it is also very important for Fox News to be seen as a news organization.
I want to ask you about one more thing that took place this week, and that was the debut of Fox Nation, the streaming app for Fox superfans.
What happens when you raise fuel taxes to pay for your environmental whims? Your country burns in protest.
Our dog is an Australian Shepherd, Harley, and he is amazing with the Frisbee. So he has a great big yard out here, and he and the Vice President come out and play Frisbee at least once a day.
A lot of times you have infighting in families. We've been so fortunate we've never had that. You know, Don's my best friend in the world. Ivanka's my best friend. I mean, we are immensely close as a family, which is why we've always operated very well.
This is Ivanka, who's doing a tremendous job. Going all right?
I have so many questions about what the strategy is here. You know, I have some guesses, but I wonder what you think.
Well, these early streaming programs are always a bit of a disaster when they first come on the market. They're sort of embarrassing. And this is no exception. But the people whose opinion Fox cares about are not the media writers in New York. It's the people who are actually going to sign up for this thing. This thing, I think, is, let's just say euphemistically, finding its way. But I do think that what this streaming service will help people really see and define is the taste of the superfan of Fox News. And that could be an interesting mirror for people to look in.
Well, Sarah, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Ellison covers media and politics for The Washington Post.
Coming up, trying to drive home reality by way of satire.
It's a perilous road. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It seems that in the end, what with the absurdly enduring argument over global warming and the stupefying effect of primetime Fox News, This hour is once again about the struggle for the narrative. If you can command enough media, you can make an impact by simply and loudly disbelieving inconvenient truths. If you are a major media outlet in emotional alignment with a powerful political minority, you can be a locus of alternative reality and an amplifier of rage. If you seek to, as they say, give voice to the voiceless, you may try satire, but it's risky, as you'll hear. Mexico's new left-wing president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, takes office this weekend, and there's a crisis waiting for him. 6,000 people are living in a tent city and an overcrowded shelter in Tijuana. Heavy rains and flooding this week added to the challenges they face, which already include President Trump's threat to permanently close the border. On both sides of the border, the caravan has served as a catalyst for concern about migration. OTM producer Alana Casanova-Burgess has the story of an attempt to raise the specter of the baseless aversion to the struggling migrants by spoofing that loathing. That was the intention anyway, but it's not what happened. Not at all.
Oscar Estrada runs a news website in Honduras called El Pulso, or The Pulse. A few weeks ago, he was on Facebook when he came across a post from one of the country's TV networks, Channel 6. As of this writing, the post has been shared nearly 50,000 times. It read, "Watch the ad created by a group of Mexicans against Central American migrants."
And at the beginning, I was kind of surprised by what they were saying.
It started with footage of Trump.
"We will build a great wall along the southern border, and Mexico will pay."
Then, a montage of Mexicans saying they refuse to pay for it.
"Yo no voy a pagar ese muro.
Yo no voy a pagar ese muro.
Yo no voy a pagar ese muro."
Because they are the wall.
"Porque yo soy ese muro.
Yo también soy el muro.
Yo también soy ese muro."
Against the invasion from Central America, they were linking arms, declaring that they would keep the migrants out. "Somos el muro. We are the wall."
"Somos el muro."
Del Caribe.
I thought it was so strange that it was such a good quality video about such an awful thing.
Oscar Estrada is a filmmaker too, so he knows good production. The video stung. It felt personal.
"More than half of my family went to the United States in the last 30 years, and I know that they have very hard experience there. And I know how it feels to be an immigrant too. And because I know what's happening in the United States, and I know it's a waiting for them. It's like seeing somebody going into a trap, you know." Then I saw the singing part, and it's the point when I realized that it was a satire.
"We are the world, somos el muro."
The video looks like it was made as a response to the so-called caravan of migrants that set out from Honduras on October 13th, and which is now halted at the U.S.-Mexico border, caught between Trump's anti-migrant policies and Trump-like rhetoric from some Mexicans.
Demonstrators carried banners reading "No to the invasion" and "Mexico first."
Many of the sentiments echoed the words of Tijuana's mayor, Juan Manuel Gastelum, who said in an interview with Milenio Television, quote, "Sure, there are some good people in the caravan, but many are bad for the city."
But the video was actually created last year, when a group of artists and activists met in Mexico to brainstorm projects that would bring awareness to what they saw as a serious but hidden problem of xenophobia in Mexico.
People were not talking about it. It wasn't something that was at the front of the Mexican imaginary at that point.
Marlene Ramirez Cancio is with the Hemispheric Institute of Performance and Politics at New York University, and she's one of the video's creators. They wanted to approach the issue with humor and take a page from the Yes Men, an activist group that famously pranks massive corporations and which collaborated on the video.
One of the specific uses of satire and parody that we wanted to experiment with is an action that puts something out there in a satirical way, although initially it is meant to be taken as real and then revealed as not so.
A classic example of this kind of bait and switch is when, for the 20th anniversary of a terrible pesticide leak in Bhopal, India, the Yes Men set up a fake Dow Chemicals website in 2004 and ended up on the BBC.
Well, joining us live from Paris now is Jude Finisterre. He's a spokesman for Dow Chemicals, which took over Union Carbide.
I'm very, very happy to announce that for the first time, Dow is accepting full responsibility for the Bhopal catastrophe. We have a $12 billion plan to finally, at long last, fully compensate the victims, including the
real Dow Chemical, then had to issue a press release hours after the BBC interview, saying essentially, no, we're not doing the right thing. The trick is that viewers have to think the satire is real, that it's within the bounds of possibility. Someone could believe this.
The discomfort created by satire is part of the deal. It can be sort of dangerous. That's not a reason, in my view, to shy away from it, especially when something is incredibly urgent.
In the We Are the Wall video, a progression of different characters say what they do to migrants.
A lot of these things had been called to our attention because of what they call the doble moral, the double standard of Mexicans really hating on Trump and the way that he treats Mexicans in the States, and then turning right around and espousing Trumpian views on Central Americans. So we saw tweets that were, oh, we should receive those migrants with a bullet to the head, and horrible things, or, you know, a lot of assumptions about women being prostitutes as well.
One of the characters in the video says, they steal your husband, especially the Honduran women. They tie them down with a kid and boom, they get naturalized.
Or another one says, I call the police. They're not supposed to take them away, but they do anyway. Another person would say, I charge them triple. Or I pay them half.
The target isn't just violent racists. It's the people who use soft bigotry to prey on the most vulnerable.
And so finally, when they pan to the left on this one character who's a passenger in the taxi, he just simply says, I don't do anything.
Yo no hago nada.
And then one of the main characters comes up to the window and with a thumbs up sign says, it doesn't matter.
No importa. Al no hacer nada, también eres parte del muro.
By not doing anything, you're also a part of the wall. Your silence is one more brick. So that's one of my favorite lines.
And you're not Mexican.
I'm not Mexican. I'm Puerto Rican.
And you don't live in Mexico. And yet this line still really hits you.
Yeah, because it applies anywhere where you are seeing problems around you and it might not affect you directly, or you think it doesn't affect you directly. You do nothing to help. You watch people be taken away. You watch people be talked about in certain ways. You say nothing. You do nothing. You're part of the problem.
So the message is harsh, but it ends with a wink, a big one.
I personally thought there's no way people are going to believe this is real. This is We Are the World and some ridiculous song called Eres Tú from Mocedades, from Spain, from the 70s. There's, you know, it's impossible that this is going to be taken as real. But either the world is crazy or crazier than I thought and this could be real, or maybe some people were not watching it all the way to the end.
The truth is that the video did not exactly go viral in Mexico when it was released in January. Neither did the big reveal, which included a red satire disclaimer on the website and links to groups that help migrants. And that was that. It was over. But in October, when the caravan started making its way up from Honduras, the group posted it again on Facebook. And then...
Esta mañana, en Abriendo Brecha,
an Honduran news network saw it.
El movimiento mexicano Somos el Muro.
And they totally didn't get it.
Very conservative channel, very anti-communist, anti-leftist. Sometimes they become themselves a joke. I would compare it with Fox News.
Again, Oscar Estrada.
And they were broadcasting the video on the news and commenting it as really outrageous about what the Mexicans were doing to the Honduras. But at the same time, they were like saying, look, this is the reason why we think the people shouldn't go in this caravan.
The network is one of the outlets in Honduras that has been spreading conspiracy theories about the migrants.
These people is being manipulated by the opposition, the leftists, to go into this caravan because the Mexicans don't want us there and things like that.
Oscar says it's not rare for news outlets and politicians in Honduras to mistake satire for reality. He's seen Mexico's version of The Onion, El Deforma, cited as a real news outlet in Honduras. The joke gets missed. A lot.
To understand satire, you have to be able to understand the truth.
This particular satire wasn't meant for Hondurans. It was meant for Mexicans.
Yes, but we thought it was for us. It was meant to be something for Mexico, but it was about Hondurans.
And so this particular video spread quickly. There are over 10,000 comments on one post. A few point out that it's satire, and some even come to the defense of Mexicans. They helped me when I tried to make the journey to the U.S. Many of them have big hearts. These people don't represent the whole country. All of which is true. Many towns in Mexico have come together to help the caravan. But many of the commenters also seemed hurt.
It's cruel. I mean, the video, it's cruel.
Ana Francis Mor is an actress based in Mexico City, and she plays the main character in the video.
And when you do satire, sometimes you are very sure that you are not crossing the line of violence, that you are not crossing the line to hurt people. But there are some times when you want to risk more, when you are talking about urgent issues like a genocide that is taking place in the south border, you have to take more chances. So I didn't know if it was going to work, if it wasn't too much cruelty.
Now that Ana Francis has seen the reaction to the caravan and the difficult position of thousands of asylum seekers trapped in Tijuana, she says maybe that tone was necessary because the situation is cruel too.
Yes, I mean, the caravan have helped the video make sense.
In fact, the presence of thousands of visible migrants has brought out more vicious rhetoric. Montserrat Narro is with the Migration Issues Program at the Ibero-American University in Mexico City. She says, it's no longer, I can take advantage of this person. Now it's, I don't want this foreigner here. The message escalated in tone. Now it's more violent. Montserrat is also with a group called No Somos El Muro. We are not the wall. It's not a reference to the video, she said. It's a response to all the bad press around the migrants. So they're trying to present more positive images to counter the Trump-like rhetoric and to highlight solidarity with the migrants across Mexico. She doesn't think satire is the right tool for the problem.
La tierra ya estaba fértil para discursos de ese tipo.
The ground was already fertile for that kind of discourse.
Un video de ese tipo,
a video of that kind isn't going to be taken as a joke. It's going to be taken as part of a stance, an affirmation. At a time when even the most extreme views seem within the bounds of acceptable discourse, perhaps the satire was too plausible, too real, about an issue too universal.
Every time that we got a big immigration of poor people, you find a group of people rejected them.
Oscar Estrada says there's even a word for it, aporofobia, or fear of poor people. In the Dominican Republic, it's Haitians. In Chile, it's Peruvians.
Or even Costa Rica against the Nicaraguan is this rejection of people coming to their countries, saying the same thing, that they're taking our jobs, they're criminals, they bring in disease. And I see it over and over again, and I think it's part pretty much of every society. It's just need the right situation to come out.
Maybe, as Montserrat says, satire is the wrong tool for shining a spotlight on our worst inclinations. Because these days, those inclinations are always on the verge of getting worse, outpacing our exaggerations. No wonder the message in this case got crossed, taken too seriously in Honduras and ignored in Mexico. Even the silly line in the We Are the Wall video about Honduran women stealing husbands provoked a debate in the comments section about which kinds of women were really the best at stealing a spouse. It's hard to imagine a parody that would convey the attitudes of those who would tear gas migrant families at the border. But here's Ronald Colburn, president of the Border Patrol Foundation, this week on Fox and Friends, explaining how benign his pepper-derived tear gas really is.
It's natural. You could actually put it on your nachos and eat it. So it's a good way of deterring people without.
There's a rule of the internet called Poe's Law, which says it's impossible to create an effective parody of extreme views because there's no view so extreme that it cannot be mistaken for the real thing. For On the Media, I'm Alana Casanova Burgess.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Feder, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chaturvedi. We had more help from Samantha Maldonado. Special thanks this week to Jose Olivares. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.